Okay, make sure you're in fellowship as we're here trying to work out verse 4, which I believe we are, to give us the precise interpretation of the issue in regards to the Nephilim that Moses makes clear comes from the human genetics as Nephilim, giants, the human race, gigantism, as it existed during his time as well as in pre-diluvian times. And it is that this strain of human beings is one of the options that the fallen angels had to procreate with and produce half angelic, half giant beings in regards to the situation at hand. Obviously, you have to get fairly technical in regards to the Hebrew language to truly extract what's being said here. The precise translation, as I brought out in point 29, was the Nephilim existed on the earth, came into being in those days and again after. Thus being Moses' reflection upon the fact that human gigantism exists as validated in regard to his own life, whom these human giants, Nephilim, became the targets of the sons of God, or potential targets of the sons of God, could enter into the daughters of men, and they will bear children to them. And again, the future tenses in the Hebrew, the imperfect is the verb could enter into or go into. That denotes action not completed, hence potential action, future potential action. Whereas the second verb, to bear children, is also future tense, but it is in the perfect with the wow consecutive, denoting completed action, indicating and relating to us that indeed sons of God did go into these, those of that strain, and they did produce offspring through the human giant human race in this regards. These are the ones that technically are the mighty men of old, the men of renown. Moses has found the kernel of truth in regards to the legend that existed at his time and still exists to a certain degree in mythology even today, in regards to where the superhuman beings that dominated the planets, looked upon as being gods, etc., came from. And he is telling us that they came from the fallen angels procreating with human offspring that had lines of gigantism in their DNA. And hence they produced a super human giant in this respect. So that makes complete and total sense, of being the ones who are the exceptions, the ones who do indeed get the notoriety in regards to mythology and legend stemming from their very existence. Because, as we know, human giants are super strong to begin with. And now you got the whole aspect of adding angelic DNA to their gene pool. And you have these exceptional super human beings that roamed on this planet. So point 40, where we left off, to again try to put it in perspective for you what's going on here. Human giants are the most physically powerful among the human race. One movie, I can't think of the name of it offhand, but you have Andre the Giant in it. And it's like a fantasy movie. And it shows him in the movie literally carrying a full-grown human male under his arm like this, walking. Well, you do any more reading in regards to Andre the Giant, he was in pro wrestling. Wrestlers, they just talked about how gentle he was because they knew he could kill in the ring. I mean, people that have true gigantism as part of their gene pool are very powerful, very strong. So you've got this situation, you've got these human giants that existed during the antediluvian period. They became an option in regards to the fallen angels to engage in this sexual intercourse, produce these offspring, whoever the angels chose. See, that's what the verse said before. Whoever they chose. Well, part of their choosing was this race of giants in order to produce then super powerful individuals. So 41, couple their genetics with the angelic DNA of the demonic extraterrestrials, and a new breed of Nephilim is born. So this is what I meant about being more specific in regards to identifying the Nephilim. The Nephilim, to begin with, were human Nephilim. But after the half-angels got done with their race and bred with them, then they produced super Nephilim. See? That's where you get the super powerful legends that has been passed down through oral and written tradition over human history. So 42, the adjective mighty men, which is Gibor, means those of exceptional power and skill. That word goes beyond just being strong. We're talking about exceptionally strong. Exceptionally skillful. Genesis 10, 8, and 9. In regards to Nimrod, the son of Cush, who gained the reputation of being an exceptionally powerful hunter in his time. And the reason is, that if you want to put two and two together, is that he lived during a time that the dinosaurs still resided, and this is probably what he hunted and why he had such a reputation in this regard. It wasn't just some little elephant tusk that he was after. He was after these huge mammoth creatures, possibly the dragon type of creatures. And here's our term. He became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. That is a statement of complete accuracy, see. God recognized this. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. So you see this in association with deity, with unbelievable skills and ability and power that's associated with Nimrod. Then Joshua 1:14. A term used there. In regards to certain soldiers, your wives, your little ones, your cattle shall remain in the land which Moses gave you beyond the Jordan. But you shall cross before your brothers in battle array, all your valiant warriors, the ones who stood out from the rest, the ones who are most courageous, most expertise in regards to their abilities, and shall help them, the ones that really had the guts and would storm the machine gun nest or whatever, say, spear nest, I guess, arrow nest. So there's our term there, translated valiant. 6:2, another similar use. Lord said to Joshua, say, I've given Jericho into your hands with his king and the valiant warriors, even the best an exceptionally adept at warfare, is the idea, and used other times in the same vein. 43, this particular adjective is used to describe the omnipotence of God. In Deuteronomy 10:17, that gives you a real indication of the emphasis. Place upon this word. For the Lord your God is the God of gods and the Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God. Obviously, you're dealing with omnipotence in regards to God. All powerful. But that's our term. The awesome God does not show partiality nor take a bribe. Come on, God. Cater to me. See. I'll pay you off. I'll get my act together later. Cut me some slack. Yeah. I see you're a gambler in life. So 44, so that's the emphasis behind this term mighty men. Not just somebody that was stronger than usual, greater than usual, more powerful than usual. No, these are offspring that were exceeding, exceptional, unique in this regard. So 44, the new and improved Nephilim. Put that in a commercial. Became a kind of super race that could accomplish the impossible and perform extraordinary feats of strength. So 45, the phrase following men of name, which is Ish Shem in the Hebrew, looks to their reputation and fame brought about by their abilities to conquer, subdue, and dominate others. 46, this conjures up the legends of those such as Hercules, Zeus, Jason, Perseus, etc., others of mythological standings. And you had others that, you know, in these mythologies that were great warriors, etc., but then you had the gods step in. And there was really no competition. So 47, while all half-angelic human beings possess abilities beyond the norm, which they would, naturally, the Nephilim strain of females bred by the fallen angels produced a breed of its own. A breed of its own. The ones that gained the notoriety. So 48, so the Nephilim were strains of human giants bred by the demons, producing half angel, half human Nephilim, essentially uncontested by the rest of humanity. So our interpretation is that the Nephilim are half angel, half human beings, but in the interpretation process, the use of Nephilim in the beginning of the verse refers strictly to human giants. Then after the fallen angels, the demons bred into their race, their DNA, they produced then super Nephilim that became the mighty men of old, the men of renown, a breed all their own. And they're still Nephilim. But now they're half-angelic Nephilim. See? So that's your interpretation of the verse. That's where everything fits in. That's the only way that all the language actually does fit. And it's hard to find commentaries that can put every little bit of the language into the verse and explain it. So 49, and now just as controversial the identities of the sons of God and the Nephilim, so is the size that giants were in the past. And that's another note of interest. If you've ever done any investigating research on your own. 50, mainline archaeology and science refutes most claims of giants exceeding 8 to 10 feet. If you start doing research on it, most mainline, the evolutionist type, generally speaking, usually, but most mainline science, most mainline archaeologists, they just dismiss anything going beyond, you know, maybe 9, 10 feet. Today, 7 feet. It's been a long time since I heard anybody ever getting up close to 8 feet again. It seems like when I was a kid that there was rumors of someone being that tall. I can't verify that, but generally that's about as big as humans get anymore. The gene pool has wore down over the years. The environment's had its toll. It's all that gravity. 51, obviously many fraudulent claims have arisen given occasion to disparage biblical ideas otherwise. In research, you'll run across these articles, 25, 30 foot people. Well, you got to be really careful when you're going through the internet. Now, just because it's on the internet doesn't mean the guy's really French and he is suave and debonair. You ever seen that one? It's on the internet. It's got to be true. No, you got to do your research. And there obviously have those who have taken advantage of people's imaginations or whatever and try to come up with fraudulent claims for their own personal agendas. And this is one, I just put a parenthesis, this is definitely one of the satanic ways of smear tactics. Satan loves to take people that are not adjusted and that will run under the FCA and go in and then do things so that they can give, you know, they give Christianity a black eye. Then on the other coin, you got people that want to reject Christianity and don't want to appeal to the Bible as being accurate at all. So that's the kind of world we live in under this ruler of the world, Satan. So that's just a typical satanic smear tactic, having that kind of stuff. So you just go through all the garbage and you find what you can document and find as being factual. So 52, that's point 52, to avoid unnecessary confrontation, we will simply note a couple of cases prominently documented to show that giants beyond stature found today have existed. There are some that they cannot dismiss. You have the case of the giant of Castelnau, which is studied at the University of Montpellier, France. He is dated in the Bronze Age. I noted Genesis 4:22. Tubal Cain, bronze and iron. See, so the antediluvian period, and he's dated in that period, which I thought was ironic. He measured 11 foot 5 inches. You figure a basketball goes 10 feet. Now, growing up, it was my goal to be able to dunk a basketball. Then I got wise, so it's my goal to just be able to touch that rim. I think maybe I did once or twice. And thank God for that guy on his hands and knees down there below so I could jump up off of him. See? Well, 11 feet. 11 feet and a half, see. Another foot and a half. Put him with the Cavaliers. LeBron James is going, I'm moving on. Again. All right, now I'm getting political, am I not? In 1842, continuing on here, another discovery at a prehistoric cemetery in Montpellier, France, which is 5 kilometers southwest of Castelnau. That should be an L there, not an I. They found skulls 28, 31, and 32 inches in circumference. That's big. That's a big head. Along with other gigantic bones indicating height between 10 and 15 feet. These bones were reportedly sent to the Paris Academy for further study. It's just a couple of deals off of Wikipedia that you can look up, and then you can validate it otherwise. So these are things that are generally recognized by historians as least accurate records of what has been claimed and written and recorded. So 53, now the actual size of the Nephilim is really only a technical consideration. Whereas the real issue is that those of giant human lines became the most powerful of the angelic progeny. That is what Moses is truly bringing out here. You get somebody like Goliath, and if he was half an angel, you got a whole different story. See, as powerful as he was at 9'9". But obviously, I'm of the opinion that people probably were a lot bigger. He had a perfect, pristine environment. The gene pool was fresh at that point in time. So, but unless something comes up otherwise, and I find, we have to wait and see. So 54, now though these were half angel, they also were human and all possessed a soul and were in need of salvation. Now, this is just deductive reasoning. If you've ever wondered in regards to things such as 55, with the distraction of their physical attributes, it is easy to see their blindness to any need for salvation. As strong as the SCA is, obviously volition is volition. It's positive or it's negative. But a strong SCA obviously can be a very big deterrence in regards to positive volition expressing itself. 56, arrogance would be one thing that would arise out of a race such as this. All their heritage aspects. Oh, we came from immortals. You're super being. You can be like a god. You are a god. You know, all these things. And they're raised up with this stuff, see. Arrogance reigned, plus they were offspring of immortal beings. 57, perhaps the demons promised immortality as part of their deception and irresistible charms. These aliens that came to visit Earth in this fashion. Now, on the other end of the coin, I mean, you like to think about things. They're also half angels. Well, there's no salvation for angels. What role does that have to play in regards to all this? I don't know. I can't answer that. I did good to get this verse deciphered for you. '58, now our interpretation of the sons of God being fallen angels is the only reasonable explanation in interpreting this verse. Otherwise, this verse really would make no sense whatsoever. But recognizing that sons of God indeed are a certain number of these fallen angels procreating with human females is what makes this verse real. 59, now as an aside, in looking at commentaries and other attempts at interpretation, interpreters tend to scratch their heads as to why the Israelites dubbed the giants, the sons of Anak, in the land as fallen ones. Why did they call them Nephilim in the Numbers 13:33 and then in 14:1? They're also mentioned again. They gave him the report in verse 33. These giants, called the fallen ones, Nephilim. And then verse 1 of 14, that all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. Talking about a night of nothing but nightmares in considering having to go up against this particular race of beings that existed these giants, etc. But Moses, in Numbers, doesn't call them giants. He calls them Nephilim, fallen ones. And most interpreters can't come up with why that occurs. 60, as I noted earlier, the Hebrew term for giants in the Hebrew, the Hebrew term for giants is Rephaim, R-E-P-H-A-I-Y-M. 1 Chronicles. Verses 4, 6, and 8 uses the term, the technical term for giants in the Hebrew. And this, in regards to the Philistines, again, now it came about after this, that war broke out at Gezer with the Philistines. Then Sabekai, the Hushathite, killed Sipai, one of the descendants of the giants. That's our technical term for giants in the Hebrew. And they were subdued. And then it talks about another giant, verse 6. And again, there was a war at Gath, where there was a man of great stature who had 24 fingers and toes. There's a couple extra there. 6 fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each foot. And he also descended from the giants. So part of that line. Part of this genetic mutation or DNA inclusion within the human gene pool produces this. And then verse 8, these were sent from the giants in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. Didn't bother David. So when God's with you, it didn't make any difference who you're facing. So my suggestion is this. This is what makes total sense to me, why this term was borrowed in this report by the Jews. That's point 61. We might suggest that the Israelites borrowed from oral tradition and legend, equating them and their enemy with the same evil and fear associated with the unnatural creatures of old. It was a form of over-exaggeration to try to drive their point home. There is no way in hell we can conquer these people. As you saw, the fear that it put in the entire congregation of Israel in regards to this report. Obviously, all this is a manifestation of sin, fear, lack of faith, rest, etc., etc. If people understood and knew tradition, that would be one way that they could describe the giants in an over-exaggerated way to denote somebody that there's no way we can conquer these people. See? That's my suggestion. That makes sense. So 62, it is a remarkable thing that angelic DNA could unite with human DNA and produce a viable organism. It is very remarkable. But you figure angels can externalize or materialize themselves in a human form. We have it in the revelation to John, other aspects of Scripture. So why could they not? If they had the ability to become flesh, if you will, tangible, why could they not be able to construct their own DNA cells to match the human chromosomes and DNA? And really, when you think about things in the Bible, it's really no more supernatural than the rapture. You know, we hold to that. We believe that. One of these days, bam, we're out of here. Our bodies are going to change into supernatural bodies. No. There is so much in regards to God's creation and existence surrounding God that we don't know. Even our own technology is bringing about things that people would have considered centuries, decades ago as impossible. One of the cooler ones that I've seen lately is a real flying saucer that they're planning to send to Mars. I mean, it looks like a flying saucer. Somebody told me that and I'm not going to get this exactly right, but you'll get the general picture, that information, technical information, over human history over the past 100 years, like over 30 years, last 30 years, doubled. And they said by the year 2020 that they didn't, that information will double every 3 days. It's a time, understanding that we live in a time that's prophesied, that people going to and fro, wisdom, technology, knowledge will be unbelievably abundant. So I tell you that, you know, because how about the deal with the Antichrist and his image in the temple? The technology that they'll have for that, you'll walk up to that image and you won't be able to tell the image from the real thing. See? But anyway. So, the supernatural. It's not anything new. It's been going on since creation of the world. Been going on since God. So, but still, it's a remarkable thing to be able to cross genus of aliens with humans in this regard. 63, yet evidence exists on our planet suggesting a very remarkable past human history. Again, there's things on this planet that cannot be denied that is made by human or some type of intelligent being that people, we cannot explain. One of the cooler ones is those markings on those plateaus, I think, down South America, where it's at. And you can only see it from the air, but it's completely and perfectly symmetrical in design and all these other things, and it points to the stars and things. As I've mentioned before, we still can't even explain how they built the pyramids. And we think we're smart. Well, maybe one of these days, when the information trip doubles every 3 days, we'll figure it out. Who knows? So, people can poo-hoo the Bible all they want. Don't let it bother you. Nothing new under the sun. So 64, now Satan's strategy here, as we, most of us know, was to corrupt the human gene pool so Messiah could not come on the scene as genuine humanity. And that thinking also kind of helped me in regards to interpreting this verse. Because now these half-angels, this was one of their objectives. So what are you saying, that every half-angel, half-human being was the man of renown? No, these are exceptions. This is why Moses is pulling this out in this verse. And that's where, when you put it together with the giants, you know, now you do have an exceptional being that's in existence out of this alien progeny with the human beings. So the task at hand was try to corrupt the human race so that the seed of the woman would not happen. Messiah had to be purely human. There is no salvation for angels. It had to be purely human. Salvation for mankind. 65, this was an attack on the line of Christ that of course failed. 66, as we noted in verse 3, punishment befell the sons of God. They had relations having been confined since the flood of the Sheol Tartarus. While Moses doesn't address it here, we know through the New Testament that these particular demons that attempted this frontal assault on God's plan in mass were indeed dealt with by God in judgment. 67, Jude 6 mentions a certain group of angels that, quote, did not keep their own domain, but abandoned their proper abode. Their first estate. That being angel, proper abode, being celibate. He has kept an eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. Or maybe it's vice versa. 68, their sin, obviously, in Jude, was of sexual nature. And like the people that lived in Sodom and Gomorrah, such as Jude 7 brings out, were judged accordingly. Now, you got to, obviously, got to take Scripture and put it in its proper context. And we dealt with this to a certain degree, obviously, in Peter. There's a parallel passage in Peter. Here I'm pulling out Jude for us. So the angels that did not keep their domain is the same context, verse 7, just as Sodom and Gomorrah and cities around them, since they in the same way as these indulged in gross immorality, went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire. So, 69, the just as, beginning Jude 7, links the angelic cohabitation episode with the reason for the annihilation of the two cities in the days of Abraham. Now, this ammunition I'm giving you in regards to this is priceless, because you got believers out there, you got theologians that completely deny the sons of God being angels. And they're saying there's no place in the Bible that you can point to this. But yet there's all this information that we see. And here it is. When you put it in its proper perspective and you have a correct understanding, then it marquees itself that indeed it is true. So there is a link between the angelic cohabitation in Jude with Sodom and Gomorrah. So 70, like the homosexuals of Sodom and Gomorrah, so too the, quote, sons of God, end quote, indulged in gross immorality and went after strange flesh. Both parties are guilty of this. See. 71, 2 Peter 2, 4 through 6 harmonizes with Jude and includes the Sodom and Gomorrah episode also as a precedent for divine wrath upon those engaged in sexual immorality. A lesson to be learned. But of course, over time, it's amazing how people forget. Uh, 72, as we know, these same angels, or as we've studied, will make a brief appearance on the earth during the tribulation under the fifth trumpet judgment, as recorded for us, as we saw in Revelation 9, 1 through 11, the demon locusts. The fifth angels sounded, and I saw a star from heaven, Revelation 9, 1, which had fallen to the earth. And the key of the bottomless pit was given to him, another angel. And he opened the bottomless pit, which is technically Tartarus, Sheol Tartarus, where these fallen angels have been incarcerated since the flood. And smoke went up out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by the smoke of the pit. Now the smoke came forth, locusts upon the earth, and power was given them, as the scorpions of the earth have power. And they were told that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, nor any green thing, nor any tree, but only the men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. So their only target are human beings. See, in regards to what they can do to this planet. They can only target human beings. Is that ironic? Well, yeah. And here, unbelievers, ones who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads, and they were not permitted to kill anyone, but to torment for 5 months. Their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings a man. In those days, men will seek death and will not find it. They will long to die, and death flees from them. And the appearance of locusts was like horses prepared for battle, and on their heads, as it were, crowns like gold, and their faces like the faces of men. The supernatural manifestation of something that you would expect from mythology. They had hair like the hair of women. Long hair on men is an abomination. It is a reflection of open rebellion to God. You know, at least believers ought to be able to at least physically appear adjusted. But not in the fundy world. Their teeth were like the teeth of lions. Near the breastplate, like breastplates of iron. And the sound of their wings is like the sound of chariots of many horses rushing to battle. They had tails like scorpions and stings, and their tails is their power to hurt men for 5 months. And they had king over them, the angel of the abyss. This is a leader. This is a general basically headed Satan's attack originally, and is part of this whole regime. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek he has the name Apollyon. another reference to mythology. First woe is past. Hang on. It only gets better. Paraphrasing. So, as we know, 73, for 5 months on their trek around the earth, they will torture men, but are not allowed to kill anyone. 74, no other angels are in hell. So the identity of the demonic invasion of Revelation 9 must be the sons of God in Genesis 6. They're the only ones that would be incarcerated. It's brought out in Jude and in Peter. And we know the other angels are not in hell. They're free to roam about just along with Satan. Job 1:6. Now there was a day when the sons of God, our interpretation of angels, came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. Be nobody else but angels. 2:1, repeat. Matthew 4:1 and following. There, obviously, Christ's temptation by Satan. Well, if he's in hell, what's he doing on planet Earth tempting Jesus? So, that's chapter 4. Ephesians 6:12 tells us that in our battle, our Christian battle, that we are in opposition to forces presently active that are spiritual in nature. Ephesians 6:12. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness. Well, if they're all in hell, how can we be battling them? No, they're free to influence humanity against the spiritual of wickedness in the heavenlies. They're able to exist, coexist in our universe proper, in stellar space, as well as being on the planet, as they may be, as Satan may orchestrate them and organize them in regards to their residence and tactics, etc. Jude 9. But Michael the archangel, when he disputed with the devil and argued about the body of Moses, did not dare pronounce against him a railing judgment, but said, "The Lord rebuke you." So Satan was free when Moses died. God took Moses' body because he knew exactly what men would do it to. They would try to enshrine him and make him a god and worship him. The celebrity ship of men. See. And Satan saw it as a tactic. And you never know when elect angels are in there covering our butts big time in the human race. Especially on behalf of believers whom they serve. And then Revelation 12:7. Of course, it still doesn't stop people, but gives them every advantage. The angelic star wars that will occur during tribulation. There was war in heaven. And so obviously they must be free to move about. Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon. And the dragon and his angels waged war. So the only logical explanation of Revelation 9 is the same angels as Genesis 6 being released from the bottomless pit. Again, we covered most of this back in Revelation. 75, in addition, Jesus made a victorious proclamation to these spirits following his resurrection in connection with relocating the souls of the Old Testament saints to the third heaven. Recorded in 1 Peter 3, 18 and 20, that we dealt with. For Christ also died for sins once for all, the just for the unjust. He's not like the crucifix shows, still on the cross bearing sins. No, he was up on that cross for 6 hours, 3 hours bearing sins. Then it is over. He was victorious from that point. In order that he might bring us to God, having been put to death in the flesh, point 18, but made alive in the spirit, in which also he went post-death, physical death, and made proclamation to the spirits now in prison. How more apropos could that be than the very scenario that we've been dealing with here in Genesis chapter 6? The first major attack in regards to the demons on the human race to try to wipe out the line of Messiah. And they're down there in the bottomless pit, in Sheol, Tartarus, all these centuries as part of their judgment being incarcerated. And all of a sudden Jesus shows up. Said, maybe not quite like that. It didn't work, see. He proclaimed victory. Satan's stratagem completely failed. Who once were disobedient. And it goes on and identify exactly who these angels are. Another verse, see. When the patient of God kept waiting in the days of Noah during the destruction of the ark, which a few, that is, eight persons, were brought safely through the water. So 76, these demons took on a suicide mission, so to speak. Obviously, they can't die. But it was totally, completely fruitless. These demons took on a suicide mission to advance the satanic cause. And if all be known, probably would have deserted had they known the consequences. That you do this, and if they knew God was going to step in and Satan wasn't going to be successful and incarcerate them over time, where all the other demons are free. If I'd been a fallen angel, I said, I'll do something else for you. Anyway, that is the Nephilim as interpreted by your pastor teacher. Father, again, we thank you for the truth of your word. We ask God, the Holy Spirit, continue to light us to these things. In Jesus' name, amen.